This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Who might run the IMF and why it matters? What to do while you're waiting for the floodwaters to arrive? And another conversation from the corner office, Xerox, this time from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on a Wednesday, everybody. It's the 18th of May today. And you know, when a company's biggest shareholder weighs in on a topic, that does tend to tilt the discussion in one direction or another. And that's exactly what's happened with the International Monetary Fund. Last night, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said it's clear Dominic Strauss-Kahn can't run the IMF anymore. So now, as the criminal process unfolds in Manhattan, the search is on for a suitable replacement. Suitable here being defined as acceptable to everybody. No easy trick in international finance, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The IMF's mission is to help countries cope with a financial crisis, lending them money, giving them advice. Economist Andrew Hilton says under Strauss-Kahn, the IMF became more vital than ever in the turmoil of the past 3 years.
Dominic Strauss-Kahn is one of the most effective leaders that the IMF has had, and he's been particularly effective in pushing for more lending more quickly to more countries.
Historically, the IMF focused on places like Africa and Latin America, but Strauss-Kahn swiftly got it involved in the Eurozone debt crisis, bailing out Greece, Ireland and Portugal. Big emerging countries like China now say it's time for a change. They want a non-European to run the IMF. Martin Wolf of the Financial Times says the Europeans won't wear that.
The idea that they would allow some outsider to make decisions which have such profound and intimate implications for all of them is, I suspect, going to prove quite horrifying to them.
He says the Europeans will insist on the top job at the IMF remaining in European hands, and they'll probably get their way.
The Europeans have about 30% of the votes. They're far and away the biggest bloc. With the United States, they're close to half. And I would suspect that the US will not oppose them on this.
If there is a race for the job, the front runner would be the French finance minister, Christine Lagarde. She's widely admired, but says Wolf lacks Strauss-Kahn's skills as an economist. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There's a big IPO scheduled on Wall Street tomorrow, one that was originally supposed to be something of a sleeper. LinkedIn, the networking site that focuses on professional contacts, is going public in the morning. It's been doing fine. The initial stock sale was supposed to weigh in at around $2.5 billion. All of a sudden, though, LinkedIn is the hot new property on Wall Street. The company is now set to raise almost $4.5 billion at the opening bell tomorrow. So we sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith out to see what lit the match under LinkedIn.
For all the stardust around social media sites, LinkedIn doesn't get much attention. But tomorrow, the entire tech world will be watching as the company puts its shares up for sale. Sam Ford is director of digital strategies with Peppercom.
People are watching this IPO as an indicator of what might be to come for Facebook, for Groupon, for a lot of other big and emerging names in the social media space.
Facebook and Groupon are expected to go public within the next year or so. Those IPOs would be around 10 times larger than LinkedIn's. But LinkedIn could be a crucial indicator of how social media plays out on public markets. Josh Burnoff is a social media analyst and author of the book Groundswell.
LinkedIn is clearly still developing as far as profitability goes. The question whether a successful but not incredibly profitable company can have a successful IPO, that's a question that a lot of companies are going to be interested in.
LinkedIn has already said that it expects to lose money next year as it invests in expanding. That might not play so well on quarterly earnings-obsessed Wall Street. And there's another real concern for investors, says Peppercom's Sam Ford. Most of a social media site's value lies in its popularity.
How can you guarantee that LinkedIn or Facebook won't become like Friendster or MySpace 5 or 6 years from now?
You can't. But what investors will be most concerned about tomorrow is what happens to LinkedIn's stock price in the next few weeks. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Oil prices rose today, so did stocks. We'll sort it out and we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Vicksburg, Mississippi has about a day to go before locals find out exactly how high the river's going to get. But they've known it's coming for weeks now. Energy Services International is among a cluster of companies there along Highway 61 in South Vicksburg. They refurbish parts for offshore oil rigs, and they were all ready to pack up and go with the river forecast to crest at 57 feet until foreman Morgan Spivey had an idea. Now, Mr. Spivey, do I understand it right that you built your own levee down there?
Actually, the first forecast we got out was 53.5 here in Vicksburg, which wouldn't affect us a whole lot. And then about 3 days later, we got another forecast of 57.5, which would have put about 3 foot in our field. And so along with me and one of our neighboring companies, we started looking around at our options and come up with the idea of topping this railroad track behind us.
How exactly do you go about building a levee? You just get a bulldozer and pile some dirt up?
Yeah, we got some equipment in there and got permission and permits from the city and started clearing the edge of the railroad tracks off and then just started hauling dirt in, topping it off.
Have you ever done anything like this before? I mean, it's...
No, I'm definitely not a dirt worker by trade, for sure. This was a new world to all of us.
It sounds like you know what you're doing, though.
Well, I mean, I guess you got to do what you want to do, to stay working. I wanted to keep my guys working. I didn't want to lay them off. So, you know, if we can spend $30,000 to $40,000 a piece or whatever it takes to keep my guys working and not be down for a year remodeling after the water would have got in there, well, that's what we're going to do.
People must have thought you were crazy building your own levee.
Well, the ones we were saving didn't.
Well, tell me about that. How many people are you saving?
Two neighborhoods, one north of us and one south of us. It's roughly 100 households and six businesses.
We talked to your boss a little while ago. He said you guys are paying for this out of your own pockets, about $85,000, right?
Yeah. It's been a group effort with five businesses here right around us. And we're just going to tally up at the end and split the bills out, and however much the damage is what it is.
Who are these companies involved? Just local businesses?
Yeah, it's just local businesses, our neighboring businesses, EMS, which is Electromechanical Solutions, Mid-South, Capert Enterprise, and LaSalle Bristol.
Can you see the water from where you are?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
How high is it?
On our levee, it's on average, it's about a foot from the top of our levee. Like I said, we're expecting crest tomorrow. So if we can fight off the sand bowls and seepage and keep water pumped out, this actually soaking through the levee, through the bedrock, we should be okay.
Well, good luck to you.
Well, I appreciate it.
Morgan Spivey at ESI in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Take care.
Thank you.
Gas at almost $4 a gallon for a national average is the consumer mantra the past month or two. But diesel, the fuel that keeps America's trucks on the road, is more than $4 a gallon right now. You multiply that by tens of thousands of tractor trailers and delivery trucks, and the companies that don't have the option of driving less are taking a big hit, which is why some of them are considering alternative power. Marketplace's Elisa Roth went along for a ride.
If you listen carefully, you might be able to hear what it sounds like when Daniel Ramos turns on his delivery truck. The truck looks like the ones around it in the supermarket parking lot, a big, boxy square. But it becomes clear why the truck is so quiet when he gets back to the warehouse at the end of his shift. He doesn't fill it up at the pump. He plugs it in. Ramos delivers chips and other snack foods for Frito-Lay. His electric truck is part of a pilot project the company's been running to test alternatives to diesel. Electric vehicles have limitations, which can make them a difficult sell to consumers. They have short ranges, and there aren't very many public recharging stations. But those limitations don't matter as much for commercial vehicles, like delivery trucks. Brian Hansel is CEO of Smith Electric Vehicles, which is the company that makes the truck Ramos drives.
They load up overnight, they get in the morning, they drive in a pretty defined route every single day, come back and park at the same place.
Other companies, for example, Coca-Cola and Staples, are also test driving Smith Electric trucks. And major truck makers, including Ford and Daimler, are looking into building electric vehicles with commercial applications.
The electric vehicles make a significant improvement in our operation.
Mike O'Connell is fleet manager at Frito-Lay. The company's trying to cut its fuel consumption in half over the next decade. He says even though the electric trucks cost $20,000 to $40,000 more than their diesel counterparts, Frito-Lay's first few dozen are already starting to pay for themselves.
Today's fuel prices are running in excess of $4 a gallon diesel. The economic return of those vehicles has been very good for us.
By the end of this year, Frito-Lay plans to have 175 electric trucks. That's out of a total fleet of 20,000 vehicles. Daniel Ramos, the delivery man, started driving the electric Frito-Lay truck about a year ago. He mostly loves it, but it doesn't have the muscle of his old diesel truck, which he says he notices as he accelerates onto the Williamsburg Bridge between Manhattan and Brooklyn.
Diesel trucks, you can, it'll kick it a little faster, but still, like, at the same point, there's really no reason to be going over 30 over the bridge, especially this bridge that they haven't fixed in years.
The truck, which says it's electric in big letters on the side, is a rolling ad for Frito-Lay's green program. But if you're not looking, you might not even know the truck is there. It's so quiet, pedestrians and cyclists are often oblivious to Ramos approaching.
So just a little toot in the horn, and they look back and they realize there's a truck there.
In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, Ursula Burns arrived at Xerox in the early 1980s. So, you know.
Right, I walked in, I was 20 years old. I had a huge afro. I dressed the time.
And now she's running the place. Another conversation from the corner office. But first, let's do the numbers. Investors got back some confidence today. They pushed the Dow Industrials up 80 points, about 2/3 of 1%, finished at 12,560. The NASDAQ bounced 31 points, more than 1%, 28.12 at the bell. The long-suffering S&P 500 finally managed to turn around at 11.9%, wrapped up at 1340. Signs of increased global demand put a new shine on copper and some other commodities. Stock and mining giant Freeport-McMoRan climbed just shy of 4%. Shares in heavy equipment maker Caterpillar rose more than 3% today. A national group of health professionals is putting pressure on Mickey D's to retire Ronald McDonald and stop marketing junk food in Happy Meals, but the news didn't curb the appetite for McDonald's stock. It sized up nearly 3/4 of 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up for Thursday. The National Association of Realtors will release existing home sales for April. The Women's Leadership Forum is hosting the 17th Annual National Issues Conference in Washington. The President and First Lady are scheduled to speak. And happy birthday to Pete Townsend of The Who. He turns 66. I'm Preeti Upadhyay.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The White House is pushing back against the notion that the debt limit deadline of August 2nd is somehow negotiable. An administration official, anonymous by the rules of the briefing today, told reporters that the Treasury Secretary is not kidding around about that. There have been some suggestions by Republicans that governmental business as usual might, in fact, be possible after August. Commentator Robert Reich takes the long view today, and he says at least part of our debt problem is the tax code.
40 years ago, wealthy Americans financed the U.S. government mainly through their tax payments. Today, wealthy Americans finance the government mainly by lending it money. While foreigners own most of our national debt, more than 40% is owned by Americans, mostly the very wealthy. This huge structural change in how America's rich finance government, from paying taxes to lending money, has gone almost unnoticed. But it's critical for understanding the budget predicament we're now in. Over that four decades, tax rates on the very rich have dropped. Between the end of World War II and 1980, the top tax rate remained more than 70%, and even after deductions and credits was well over 50%. Capital gains rates were also higher than today. Not only are rates lower now, but loopholes are bigger. 18,000 households earning more than $500,000 last year paid no income taxes at all. In recent years, according to the IRS, the richest 400 Americans have paid only 18% of their total incomes in federal income taxes. Meanwhile, more and more of the nation's income and wealth have gone to the top. We haven't had such a concentration of money at the top since the Gilded Age of the late 19th century. America's super rich invest their savings all over the world, wherever they can get the best return for any given level of risk. Treasury bills, essentially loans to the U.S. government, have proven good and safe investments, particularly during these last few tumultuous years. You hear a lot of worries about foreigners dumping treasuries if they lose confidence in the dollar because of our future budget deficits. What you hear less about are these super-rich Americans, who are just as likely to abandon treasuries if spooked by future budget deficits. The great irony is if America's super-rich finance the U.S. government the way they used to, by paying taxes rather than lending the government money, that long-term budget deficit would be far lower.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week, David Frum will be here. Send us your comments. In the meanwhile, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. It's that day of the week, so let's cue the music.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Oil has been much on our minds this past week, from the Senate vote not to eliminate tax breaks for oil companies to drilling offshore to gas at $4 a gallon. But commentator David Frum suggested another option the other day, looking north to the oil sands of Alberta. Sally Pick of Montague, Massachusetts, says that's a half-good solution.
According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, quote, tar sands extraction in Canada destroys boreal forests and wetlands, causes high levels of greenhouse gas pollution, and leaves behind immense lakes of toxic waste, unquote. While there is comfort in knowing that our oil consumption is supporting a friendly neighboring democratic country, tar sands are hardly innocuous.
Strained relations with Pakistan have some in Congress questioning continued financial support for that country. Commentator Nancy Birdsall figures aid to Pakistan is an investment in our own security. Jeanette Hughes of Key Largo, Florida, said that we ought to take care of our own first.
There are millions of young people here, too, who are struggling with lack of education, lack of training, and lack of jobs. Cuts in education are going to make it harder for our young people to compete in a global economy. I understand why we should be helping Pakistan and other foreign countries, but not at the price of undermining our own young people's future.
And finally, the internet filter bubble. Eli Pariser's book of that name explains how Google and some other sites customize searches to give us what they think that we want to see. Bryce Larson wrote in from Chicago to say that Yahoo News just doesn't understand him.
Just because I like one story about Albert Pujols being underpaid does not mean I also want to hear a story about LeBron James apologizing to Cleveland. I also must have once looked at a story about Miami because now I get feeds to the local newspapers. I do not live anywhere near Miami, nor do I care if the fish will be biting this weekend. The site can lump stories together based on category, but it's failed to categorize my interests.
We can't pretend to know what you like and what you don't, so you're going to have to tell us. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. Five years ago, for what at the time was a new segment called Conversations from the Corner Office, we talked to the then CEO of Xerox, Ann Mulcahy. Mulcahy had her hands full the first couple of years on the job, keeping Xerox out of bankruptcy. She has since retired and been replaced by a woman who's got an equally difficult challenge ahead of her, figuring out what comes after copying machines.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Ursula Burns. For most of the 100 years it's been around, Xerox has been synonymous with making and selling paper copiers. Ursula Burns is changing that. Nowadays, the company makes nearly half its revenue from back office services, what they call business processes, which means my first question to her was, what's a business process?
So if you're in New York or New Jersey and you're traveling in your car and you use anything to get into Manhattan, you realize you have to pay a toll.
Yes, you do. Big ones here.
Yeah, big ones, right? And so you can stay in a very, very long line that actually requires you to take out cash. Or you get this little transponder thing that's stuck in your car.
Yeah, FastPass or EasyPass.
EasyPass.
Right? Yeah.
So the entire process to know that your car is connected to that transponder and the bill that you get, the entire closed loop process to make sure that the state of New York and you settle each other between all the communication is done by Xerox Corporation. That's a business process. That's what we do.
All right. So there's a branding question I have to ask you. You guys had, and I imagine you will say you have, one of the world's great brands, right? I mean, you say Xerox and people know exactly what you guys do, which is, it's copy machines. How do you now change that brand image to let people know that you do EasyPass?
A lot of work.
Yeah.
A lot of work and a lot of money.
Yeah.
The best way to change it is to do it, right? And then after a while, you become it and it's easy. But we're still in the best way to change it is to do it.
I wanted to touch on your management style a little bit. You have been called hard charging. You have encouraged your employees to be more frank and impatient with each other. That's your phrase, as a way to spur innovation and get this company where it needs to be. If you encourage frankness and impatience at a lot of companies, people just get cranky and grabby, and it doesn't work out so well. Is there a risk in doing it that way?
Of course. By the way, there's a fair amount of crankiness here.
Yeah, even if people aren't cranky.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So crankiness is a human attribute that when people walk in the door of Xerox, they remain human. The best way to get the best out of people is to not force them to be something other than they naturally are. Now, what do they have to be? They have to be respectful. You can't be ridiculously disrespectful. You can't, use bad language. There's certain things that you have to kind of have reasonably good moods.
Yeah.
Besides that, you have to have a very strong opinion with some facts and data to stand it up, and then you better walk into the room with something to say, because otherwise you don't really add a whole lot of value to the group.
See, I love that, but it takes a certain amount of intestinal fortitude on management's part to be encouraging of that kind of idea.
I don't know what else do you do, though? I mean, I
don't know.
It's not clear to me how you would run the place if you said, have some great ideas, but don't express them.
I'm with you. Yeah. I think
what I found out in my career is that when I joined Xerox, the benefit I had,
which we should say was 30 something years ago. You've been here your whole career.
Yeah, I've been here my entire career. From senior year in college until this day, I worked nowhere else. So when I walked into this company, one of the things that really surprised me, this is in hindsight, right? I walked in, I was 20 years old. I had a huge afro. I dressed the times.
Right.
And looked the times. I listened to the same music I listen to today, unfortunately, but the Temptations. I was a Motown person.
Right.
I didn't quite dress like business attire because I grew up in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and the closest thing I saw to business attire was a guy who ran Safeway. He wore a tie.
Right.
So we didn't, all this stuff was new to me. When I walked in, Xerox didn't say to me, by the way, there's something that you should really know. This hair thing isn't going to work here. That attire thing, you're going to have to figure out a way to change this. They said nothing about it. It was kind of stunning.
Hmm.
What they said was, I'm going to give you an opportunity, and if you can work hard enough and learn fast enough and really be driven and focused, you are going to go a long way. And it was amazing. So I said, why would you ever leave this place?
So as I was sitting down coming up with a list of questions I wanted to talk to you about, obviously, there was one that went, okay, let's see. First African-American female CEO of a Fortune 500 company. First woman-to-woman transition from Anne Mulcahy to you in a Fortune 500 company. And then I read this line in an interview where you were talking about this issue of you being black and in this leadership position. And you said, I've been here 3.5 days, and I'm on every list of impressive CEOs everywhere and award-winning that, and I haven't done anything. Are people paying too much attention to that stuff?
I think less now than before, which is a little bit better. It is important to be an example, because it does inspire and spur people who may not have been included before. But I also know that just because I was the first woman to woman and black, if that moved me up the list, I say to myself, well, I'm really nervous here. Mm-hmm. Because in day three, I had done nothing in this new role that would have caused the movement to go up, except for actually be there. So I know how the world works. And one thing, being my young 52, is I know that when you're really, really high, that there is a long way to go down. So I would prefer to be measured on the last 2 years of work in this role and the previous 29 years of work getting to this role than having gotten there, if you know what I mean. And that's the whole thing I'm trying to keep people's focus on.
Ursula Burns, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
There is more of that interview and conversations from other corner offices on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, today I am on the record, and proudly so, on both this broadcast and on my Twitter feed, as not having cared all that much for Kate Middleton's dress. Thought her sister's was way better. But I mention that as a way to set up this item on another piece of fashion news from the royal wedding. Princess Beatrice's hat might eventually wind up doing some good. If you didn't see it, the thing has alternately been described as looking like a toilet seat or a bowl of spaghetti, and that's really being kind. Anyway, she put it on eBay to raise money for children's charities. The auction site said today that bidding has topped $30,000, which is nice. And that's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow gained 80 points, about 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ climbed 31 points, more than 1%. The S&P 500 added 11 points, 9/10 of 1%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this show.
I raised my hand in this meeting and I said, who's got the data on the entire financial system? And the answer was that nobody really has the data.
And thus was born the government's Office of Financial Research. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.